Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Thursday, January 2nd, 2025. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Montana Governor Gianforte and state officials sue National Park Service over Yellowstone Bison Recovery Plan. Man who died in Pullman garage fire identified. New analysis of potential salmon extinction. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Spokane Regional Health District announced today the first flu death for the 2024 to 2025 season in Spokane County. The patient was in their 60s with underlying health conditions. The deceased was one of 52 Spokane County residents who have been hospitalized due to flu symptoms during this year's flu season. Spokane County Health Officer Dr. Francisco Velasquez said, "Unfortunately, this is a sad example of how serious flu can be. Our hearts are with the family and friends who are grieving this terrible loss." According to the Washington Department of Health website, influenza-like illness activity is currently high in Washington. The Moscow Fire Department responded to a house fire in the 1,000 block of Sloanacre Drive early yesterday morning. According to a press release, the first fire truck reached the structure and firefighters found flames and smoke billowing from the exterior chimney, and the flames had spread to the roof. Once crews contained the fire to the chimney, they made an assessment which revealed the fire had reached an adjacent bedroom and attic space. Firefighters were able to extinguish the blaze in both areas. No injuries were reported, and the flames were kept to the chimney, attic, and bedroom. Montana Governor Greg Gianforte and Montana officials have sued the U.S. National Park Service for violating established agreements for managing bison. The case Montana filed Tuesday argues federal wildlife officials have ignored the state's concerns about bison population growth and has avoided vaccinating the animals against brucellosis, a disease that causes female cows to abort their young. The latest escalation in a decades-long conflict between federal officials over management of bison herds in Yellowstone National Park and the state of Montana. The main issue is about how to manage the bison when they roam across park boundaries into Montana. According to the lawsuit, the National Park Service changed the rules regarding bison numbers and vaccination in a 2024 environmental impact statement without consulting state officials. The lawsuit, filed by Gianforte's attorneys as well as attorneys for the Montana Department of Livestock and the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, says Yellowstone officials have unlawfully disregarded an agreement from 2000 to keep the Yellowstone National Park bison herds at less than 3,000 animals, including a commitment by park officials to vaccinate bison against brucellosis. The lawsuit says the new bison management plan is another example of Yellowstone National Park's tendency to do what it wants, leaving Montana to collect the pieces. The latest dispute began in 2000 when Yellowstone National Park implemented the Interagency Bison Management Plan. The long-term plan allowed for brucellosis-positive bison to live in Yellowstone. That concerned Montana officials because brucellosis can cause fetal abortions and sterility in livestock. However, there's no known case of bison transmitting brucellosis to livestock. The lawsuit said state officials hoped the issue would be addressed when the National Park Service updated their management plan in July, but that did not happen. They say the updated plan violates previous agreements to keep Yellowstone bison herds under 3,000 animals and avoids vaccinating them. According to research from the U.S. Geological Survey in 2016, while brucellosis has been found among Yellowstone bison, it's more likely to infect livestock via elk herds than directly from bison. Idaho lawmakers will have to decide what to do now that consultants working with the Division of Public Works have said it will cost between $64 and $69 million to renovate the State Transportation Department headquarters on State Street in Boise. That's about double the legislature, what the legislature provided last year to renovate the headquarters based on a previous Division of Public Works estimate, which came in at $32.5 million. At the end of the last legislative session, lawmakers nixed a plan to sell the headquarters and its 44-acre campus to a consortium of three companies, saying keeping the headquarters and renovating it would be a better deal for Idaho taxpayers. The headquarters building has significant flood damage from a 2022 weather event. The Transportation Department has already moved most of its operations to a state office campus on Chinden Street in Boise. According to the Idaho Press, Joint Finance Appropriations Committee co-chair Representative Wendy Horman said, "We acted in good faith on the numbers that were provided, so the discrepancy between that number and the one we're seeing now, I expect, will be a subject of robust conversation." The other co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee, Senator C. Scott Groh of Eagle, said he asked staff for the most current cost of having the transportation department established at Chinden Street, and he found the estimate was now $45 million. Groh said there's only about a $5 million difference between renovating the State Street campus versus Chinden. He said it costs less for us to stay at State Street, and we'd still own the 44 acres. That seemed like a very easy decision. Speaking of the original estimate of $32.5 million to renovate the State Street building, Department of Administration spokesperson Kim Rao told the Idaho Press in September, "This estimate was generated quickly, a rudimentary back-of-the-napkin approach, in order to give legislators an initial gauge of the financial requirements for the project. It was based on standard costs typically associated with renovation projects." A recent Idaho Conservation League report says mining for minerals is necessary but must be done in a responsible manner. The report highlighted the environmental impact of mining and took a look at the industry's best mining practices. The Idaho Conservation League's new report is unearthing Idaho mining and environmental impacts in the Gem State. According to the Idaho Capital Sun, Idaho Conservation League Central Idaho Director Josh Johnson said the report provides guidance on how to balance the demand for minerals and protect Idaho's environment. The report addressed concerns surrounding new mining projects, increased exploration, and issues concerning abandoned mines. Mines are needed to manufacture cars, cell phones, computers, and renewable energy technologies. Johnson told the Capital Sun, "Mining is a huge part of Idaho's history and in our heritage here. We are blessed with a lot of natural resources, and there is a reason for us to use those mineral resources, but I think we need to recognize that this mining is not appropriate everywhere, and it needs to be done the right way." Johnson said the organization is looking into current mining practices in Idaho on a case-by-case basis, and they are not making generalizations about the mining industry. Historian Troy Lambert said the Clean Air and Water Act significantly changed Idaho's mining practices. Lambert said before the federal Clean Air and Water Act, mines were run on the idea of dilution as the solution to pollution, which assumed polluted water would naturally clean itself as it moved downstream. He said, "If we don't mine here, it's going to happen elsewhere in the world. For a long time, it was just a really dirty process, especially the milling process. The outhouses over the stream, they poisoned the land, the water, and all of that downstream. Those dirty mining practices are still having an impact on how we manage the environment in those areas today." Before he died earlier this year, Oregon biologist Jim Liketowicz sounded an early alarm on the salmon extinction issue. According to the Seattle Times, Liketowicz and co-author Rick Williams released a book called Managed Extinction, which brought the plight of migrating salmon into the public forum. Likatowicz was an independent biologist who in 1991 published a scientific paper, Pacific Salmon at the Crossroads, which informed the public how wild salmon runs were declining everywhere in the Pacific Northwest. In December, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Reclamation took a new look at salmon recovery in the Columbia River Basin to take into account how river and salmon run conditions have changed since the approval of a 2020 environmental impact statement, which underlies Columbia River operations. Earth Justice Senior Attorney Amanda Gooden said she sees an opportunity to take a fresh look in light of new information, especially a 2022 National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration report, which said to attain the levels of fish abundance needed for salmon recovery, removing the four lower Snake River dams and other actions would be necessary. According to the Oregon State University Press publication, failures to incorporate science into fishery management and recovery programs, lessons from the Columbia River, Likatowicz and Williams took into account three impediments. One, a conceptual foundation that is not consistent with the latest science. Two, the fragmented way watersheds are managed, and three, political interference. Gooden said a report from the Interior Department acknowledged the loss of salmon in the Columbia Basin has harmed tribes in the Northwest. And you're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is made possible in part by support from KRFP members and
John's Alley Tavern, Moscow's home of live music. John's Alley is located at 114 East 6th Street in downtown Moscow.
A bill that has already passed in Congress could expand opportunities for recreation on public lands in places like Montana. The Explore Act, presented to President Joe Biden last week, would help ensure public lands and recreational areas remain accessible and fund updates for old infrastructure, among other improvements. It comes as the outdoor recreation economy has grown 36% since 2012, according to an Outdoor Recreation Roundtable analysis. Cycling is up 11%, and Jessica Zephyrs with the Missoula-based Adventure Cycling Association says she's seen increased interest in biking off paved roads.
What we've really seen growth in are things like bike packing, gravel cycling, e-bike touring, guided tours, getting outside and experiencing nature in the world.
The Great American Rail Trail could fit the bill. Announced in 2019, it's a non-motorized trail designed so a user can cross the entire country separated from traffic. The Montana section, which will run from Yellowstone Northwest through Saltese, is 25% complete, according to the Rails to Trails Conservancy. Zephyr says new and used bike sales spiked during the pandemic when more people started recreating outside. She says it's hard to tell if they're still using those bikes as other hobbies have become available again.
The hope is that we can continue to inspire and empower people to get out on those bikes, ride in a way that is exciting and empowering for them.
One section of the Explore Act specifically supports biking on long-distance trails. New data show outdoor recreation in the U.S. generated over $1 trillion in economic output last year, or 2.3% of the nation's gross domestic product. I'm Kathleen Shannon with Big Sky Connection.
Whitman County Coroner Annie Pillars has identified the man who firefighters found dead in a burning garage-like structure on College Hill Tuesday morning as 60-year-old Stephen Paul Sargent. Authorities, including the coroner's office, are investigating the cause and manner of death. Pillars made the announcement yesterday. Someone reported smoking coming from the structure surrounded by apartments in the 400 block of Maple Street Tuesday morning at about 7 a.m. Firefighters contained the fire, and the fire did not damage nearby apartment buildings. The fire department turned the investigation of the death over to the Whitman County Coroner and Pullman Police Department. The Lewiston Tribune reported firefighters said the structure was filled with debris and was difficult to enter. They said they found discarded cigarettes and extension cords. On Tuesday, the paper reported the person who died did not appear to be a college student or connected with Washington State University. despite the location of the fire on College Hill, surrounded by apartments where it's mostly college students. A Pullman Fire Department news release Tuesday said fire officials will check with city building inspectors to determine if they had approved the building for a human habitation. The news release reported there was a power line connected to a nearby apartment, and there was an electric meter attached to the structure that had been on fire. After former President Jimmy Carter won the 1976 election, he appointed then-Idaho Governor Cecil Andrus as Secretary of the Interior. Commenting on the legacy of Jimmy Carter, Idaho Democratic Party Chair Lauren Necochea told the Idaho Press, Carter and Andrus, quote, championed conservation efforts that left an enduring legacy, including protecting vast wilderness areas and public lands that Idahoans treasure. Their partnership exemplified how leadership rooted in trust and shared values can make a profound difference. Beyond his presidency, President Carter's lifelong dedication to human rights, housing security, and global peace continues to inspire. Carter died Sunday at the age of 100. Cecil Andrus, who is Idaho's most recent Democratic governor, won re-election to the post after he left the Carter administration. While Andrus was Interior Secretary, President Carter signed a bill creating the River of No Return Wilderness Area in central Idaho. Carter also shared the political stage with another well-known Democrat from Idaho, U.S. Senator Frank Church. Church won Democratic primaries in Oregon and Nebraska in 1976, but Carter prevailed in the race for the Democratic nomination. Church brought a sizable number of delegates to the Democratic National Convention that year, and they lobbied hard for then-Senator Church to become Carter's running mate for vice president. A Lewiston Tribune story from that year reported Church was one of six Democrats that Carter considered for running mate. He eventually chose Walter Mondale of Minnesota. In 1984, President Ronald Reagan added Church's name to the new wilderness area after he had died. The wilderness area is now called the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness Area.
Oregon's Right to Repair Law, which increases consumers' ability to repair their own electronics, takes effect this week. The law requires manufacturers to provide access to replacement parts, tools, manuals, as well as digital keys needed so people can fix their own devices. Charlie Fisher with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group helped author the law and says it needs to go further. That's why, along with disability justice advocates, he's pushing for wheelchairs to be included. Fisher says the current process for getting wheelchairs fixed is overly complicated and takes months.
Just simple barriers that shouldn't exist are really what we're trying to address in this wheelchair right to repair law. And it just seems like common sense.
Fisher says Democratic Senator Jeanine Solman of Hillsboro will introduce two bills this year to expand the right to repair law. One bill would add these protections for wheelchairs. The other would simplify the repair process when going through Medicaid. Wren Grabham has been working on the bills and says additions to the law would require wheelchair manufacturers to post their manuals and allow a person to fix their chair without voiding their warranty. Grabham says when she was 16, her electric wheelchair began shutting off and giving an error code. Because there is no public manual for the chair, she didn't know what the code meant or if the chair was safe to keep driving. Grabham says fixing it included getting insurance approval, so it took a long time.
And so I had to pretty much use an old chair that didn't fit me for 6 months.
Grabham says even simple routine fixes like getting a new tire or battery for her chair take months because she has to prove the new parts are needed.
Even though it's something that we could fix in a weekend, if we were able to actually get the parts to fix them.
Osberg's research finds being able to fix phones, computers, and appliances instead of buying new ones will save the average Oregon household more than $300 a year. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Wyoming's State Capitol Building has been a National Historic Landmark since 1987. Last month, the Department of the Interior updated the designation with a new context, women's suffrage. The updated federal designation honors Wyoming's important role in being the first governing body to allow women the full right to vote in 1869, when the area was a recognized territory. When Wyoming joined the Union in 1890, local leaders brought women's suffrage with it. Karen Meister Emmerich with the League of Women Voters of Cheyenne said there were national attempts to block the move.
And that was a big controversy nationally. And the governor said, well, we'll wait 100 years if you don't let our women come in voting. So very different from other states.
Wyoming, the 44th state to join the union, coincidentally ranks 44th in the nation for the proportion of women currently in its state legislature, according to the Center for American Women in Politics. It's difficult to tell what the state's historical motivations were for women's suffrage. According to Robin Hill with the League of Women Voters of Wyoming, some theories include territorial leaders wanting more women to move there, that one political party believed it would win women's votes, or that women pressed male members of the legislature with a strong case for suffrage.
My view, or my hope anyway, is that all those motivations might have played a part, but maybe they didn't need a whole lot of motivation. Maybe it just seemed like the obvious thing to do at the time.
The 19th Amendment federally recognized women's right to vote in 1920, more than 50 years after the Wyoming Territory did so. Wyoming has other claims to women's rights fame, including the country's first woman appointed to public office, first women jurors, and first woman governor. I'm Kathleen Shannon with Wyoming News Service.
Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, there is a 80% chance of rain tonight, mainly before 9 p.m. Snow level 3,700 feet, rising to 5,600 feet after midnight, low 34. Tomorrow, 100% chance of rain, between a quarter and a half inch of rain possible, high 41. East winds 5 to 10, becoming south in the afternoon, gusts up to 20. Friday night, 60% chance of precipitation, rain and snow likely before midnight, then a chance of snow. Snow level 3,200 feet, lowering to 2,600 feet after midnight. Otherwise cloudy, low 33. Little or no snow accumulation expected. On Saturday, 50% chance of precipitation, chance of snow before 10 a.m., then chance of rain and snow, then chance of rain in the afternoon. High snow level rising to 3,500 feet in the afternoon. Mostly cloudy, high 39. Little or no snow accumulation expected. Saturday night, 80% chance of precipitation, chance of rain before 7 p.m., then a chance of rain and snow before 10 p.m., then rain, snow level 3,500 feet, low 35, little or no snow accumulation expected, an 80% chance of rain on Sunday, snow level 4,000 feet, high 39, currently 34 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Brenda Cox and Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. Flashpoints is up next, then at 7:30, appearing locally, featuring music from artists that are appearing in the Moscow Pullman area in the near future. And at 8 o'clock, we'll have Under Construction, which is a show about community organizing, live on the air Thursdays at 8. KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is sponsored by Spectrum 2 Art and Dance Studios, specializing in art and dance classes for child
through adult. 525 South Main Street in Moscow. Information at 208-882-1445, UBU Dance Guru at msn.com, or spectrum2studio.com. For information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.